This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay respect to their elders past and present. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned that the following episode may include voices of people who are deceased. Warbadar Bunanu, Water Shield, is a 2019 documentary set in the Gulf Country of the Northern Territory. It focuses on the language groups around Borroloola, like the Gadara, Yanyuwa, Mara and Gurangi people, who are told that their drinking water is contaminated with elevated levels of lead and manganese. A large zinc and lead mine, located nearby on Nawinbi, or the MacArthur River, is thought to be the cause, but the operator, Glencore, denies responsibility. Together, the community pursues justice, all the while affirming the healing power of culture.
You know, the country, it's crying. It needs someone. It's hurt. When we sing all these songs, the country comes back to life.
A constant reference point in the film is Two Laws, a unique 1981 documentary that draws upon Indigenous storytelling practices to represent history, law and life in Borroloola.
My grandparents and great-grandparents made Two Laws in the 1970s. It showed the real power of our song, of Aboriginal law. I watched it so many times growing up. They were powerful people, and they're the one that stood up and fought to protect this country. Rise up, rise up, rise up. Today, 40 years on, contamination from the same mine is killing our river.
We learn of the film's lasting legacy and how its concerns about the impact of mining on country are still so relevant today.
Look at us now, 40 years down the track from Two Laws. We're not going to stop here. Our teaching survives in our land, in our law, in our songs. Culture is stronger than contamination.
In this episode of Seeing Green, we immerse ourselves in the world of Warbadar Bunanu. I'm very pleased to be joined in this discussion by the writer and director of the film, Jason DeSantolo. Jason's tribal affiliations are Gadara and Barangum, and it's his homelands that are in focus in this film. Jason is currently Associate Professor and Director of Indigenous Research at University of Technology, Sydney. His research practice integrates video, creative practice and renewal strategies through a Galdera-driven decolonising research paradigm. Jason, it's so great to have you on Seeing Green. Welcome.
Thanks very much. It's really, really great to be here, Dylan.
Also with us is John Harvey, an award-winning Torres Strait Islander writer, director and producer for theatre, film and television. John is the creative director of Indigenous production company Brown Cabs and was the producer of the film we're discussing today. John, thanks for being with us and welcome to you too.
Thanks, Dylan. Thanks for having us.
Absolute pleasure. And Jason, before we get into discussing this film specifically, I wonder if you can help transport us to the country around Borroloola for a moment. Describe what it looks and feels like and if you will, the nature of your connection with it.
Yeah, firstly, I just, pay respects to, you know, the elders and everyone in the film. Borroloola is it's got an amazingly rich history. It's a powerful place right in the centre of the Gulf Country of the Northern Territory. I'm often, you know, I don't live there, so I'm often travelling from Darwin on the long road. You know, it's a good 12-hour drive down, you know, and you just go sort of southeast and you hit the Gulf Country. And once you hit there, it's a powerful river country place, but it's tucked into, you know, it's semi-arid and subtropical. And Borroloola itself, you know, it's a real mash-up place. You know, four main tribes for the area, we're all kind of like mashed up there and live there. You know, there's a township that has kind of grown over the years, from once being, you know, having the largest library in the Northern Territory in the early 1900s. And, you know, and that was housed in a jail, you know, with 3,000 leather-bound books. And, you know, it's got a whole lot of history around hermits and other people. But the mob there, Gadawa, Yanyuwa, Mara and Gadangi, have always fought really hard, you know, as a unified front mainly around living healthily on country, I think, you know.
It's that Meningara River. Going down there. Just that river going down the wide, and then you got to go down there, and he said that...
That's too wide.
Hey, he was a big one, that river down there.
He in a mile and go look there.
I think Borroloola is interesting because it's the meeting point of the Nawambe River system, which is in the film. And, you know, I think Nawambe is really, it's a connector for the tribes that are connected through ceremony, and we're all related. But in particular, you know, I think with the MacArthur River and other mining activities, and, it's changed the nature of the river. And, you know, I think the film itself speaks to the resilience of the elders, in particular, and our old people, and sort of understanding the premise, one of the premises of the film, which is, culture is stronger than contamination.
Yeah, such powerful sentiments to draw upon and tease out throughout our discussion. And John, I'm interested in your connection to this story and this community. What led to you being involved in this film being made?
Yeah, you know, I just feel so fortunate to have, you know, worked with Jason and his community with this film. It's a real honour for me, and, you know, I acknowledge his elders and everyone who's holding space for these stories. And the connection for me was through Jason, and, you know, I've known Jason for a long time, and, you know, to be able to do a story with his mob, you know, and a really important story, I think, and in a way that, how do you tell this story in a way that speaks to Indigenous worldview, philosophy, way of storytelling? And because, you know, there's ways of telling stories, within the community. And I think that was a really special part of this film, the whole process. And, you know, I think in terms of this film, this storytelling process has happened well before the film, a long time ago. And in fact, we've got, like, also this old film footage from Two Laws. Within the story, there's this acknowledgement that these stories have been told for a long period of time, and how those stories have been told, and the energy of elders and wisdom and young people coming into that and also playing their role within the story, I think was really special. To make a film like this, to understand the cultural nuances and everything that come in the storytelling and relationships with people, you know, takes pretty special understanding from a filmmaker point of view. And that's what Jason, working with his mob and as a filmmaker, is bringing in his practice into telling this story.
Yeah, and we hear Scott Wojcicki McDinney talk about Two Laws right at the beginning. We actually see footage from that film. And as you say, John, it really provides, I suppose, a constant reference point in the storytelling process of both what's going on right at the time of sort of 2018, the story you're telling about water contamination, but also the broader connection to culture and country that really comes through strongly in this film. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more, Jason, about just how you worked with and used Two Laws as kind of a reference point in the filmmaking process.
I mean, it's been a really interesting time, the last decade, I think, in particular, around the pressures that the community have been facing around mining and, the extractive industries that have been really preying on territories in the Northern Territory and across the country and across the world. And I think one of the things that the elders said very early on when they got the contamination notices in Gardawa Town Camp 1, you know, was the families had known for so many years, and there'd been so many protests and so many strong representations right up to the Supreme Court and back, you know, and constantly being overturned by these successive governments. It was like, well, how do we communicate this? Because the mainstream media isn't, the government isn't hearing us. You know, it was really a sort of an ongoing discussion around, well, you know, look at what our old people did in Two Laws. You know, they spoke strongly and respectfully around living in that, you know, a legal pluralistic kind of life of, like, we respect white law, the government and other people should respect black law. The sort of dynamic nature of that storytelling, I think, started to come through again through Scotty, who has this beautiful relationship, is a real young leader for us. But, you know, like, he really came to the to the fore, and that beautiful relationship with the elders and with country in itself really comes through, hopefully, in the film.
Families are asking, can we trust this water with our kids? They know long-term exposure to lead affects all parts of the body, the growth of our babies and kids' development. We don't know how long the water has been contaminated, and we are not getting any straight answers.
And what about for you, John? I mean, what was the nature of your, I suppose, involvement in making Wobbeda Boonwurrunnoo, and how did Two Laws sort of feed into the creative process?
You know, for me, it was a fascinating thing because, you know, often with things in the community, you hear people talk about something and they say, we've been saying this for years and we're not heard. Our voice isn't heard. And I think that was a really interesting thing, to have the film footage of a particular time, you know, and to be able to reference that within our film. You know, and you can hear things that are said back then that are said now. You know, this country is just fixated with the exploitation of it. It's just so hungry and salivating for anything in the ground. And the only conversation we ever have this as a nation is, how many jobs do you get out of these things? And it's just not really a bigger conversation. It just gets so fixated. And, you know, a lot of these things happen out of people's backyard, out from, you know, their capital cities. And you get those clips on the news, you know, you get the news footage and you get these brief clips. But I think to be able to understand an impact of something on the community, and then to be able to have those conversations in a space that's not confined by a kind of news sort of parameters, is a really important thing. To be able to not just get the voices out from the local community, but to have this conversation at a national level, you know, for us, and an international level, because it's the classic kind of relationship between big business, the government, and then the local people.
The story in our land is not made up. It's been there from creation time, from Ijan. White fella call it dream time, we call it Ijan. Our law don't change. It'll never change. Some old people used to get together and speak with one voice. Like when they're in the big meeting, when government flying down, and they're talking, giving all the name of this country. Now, yes. The government wanted to know, and old people didn't like it, you know? But they have to fight back with Two Laws, because they're living in Two Laws today.
For you, John, I mean, you've made, you know, feature film, documentary in the past, sort of short film as well. You've written for the stage. You kind of dabble in a range of different visual media forms, I suppose, and live performance as well. For a film like this, I mean, do you see it as a form of advocacy, as kind of outcomes focused, where you're looking for some kind of sort of tangible response or something to come from it at all, in a different way that you might from producing a feature or fictional film?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you know, I think the commonality for me across anything is we're storytellers in this space.
Mm.
Our tools, I guess, are these particular things. And as storytellers, it's always about getting a voice, often about the voice, and getting the voice out there in the most respectful and authentic way that you can. And that's the core of things. And then how that's told in the method of making and the creative process all kind of varies around it. And, you know, the outcomes of that can be, you know, it's many things. It's advocacy, it's entertainment, you know, like it's artists telling stories in artful ways. It's kind of all of those things.
Thanks very much, everyone, for coming down today to this protest in support of people that have come all the way from Borroloola to stand here and demonstrate against these corporate criminals, Glencore, that are destroying their land.
These people are coming into our land, digging the land, Glencore mine, contaminate our water, killing our fish. We want Glencore to close down. They're damaging our country, and this is another mess we're having.
I love that country, that's where I grew up, and that river, MacArthur River, that's not its real name, it's Mawimbi.
I suppose in thinking about the broader genre of, you know, environmental documentary, which has become much more prominent in recent decades with the climate crisis and so on, and this being very much front of mind for people in a way that perhaps, you know, hadn't been so much before, but it can become a bit sort of preachy sometimes. It can talk a lot about personal responsibility, about crisis and loss, and not always really explore the actual connection to the natural world, connection to country, in sort of film form. I wonder sort of how you see this film in the context of environmental documentary, but also just what it does in celebrating story and celebrating culture and putting that very much at the forefront.
The way I see it, it's just sort of part of a lineage of storytelling from country. So, I mean, I really resonate with what John's sort of talking about, the importance of voice, you know, having voice, creating it in a way of integrity. You really want the message to have integrity, but also have a vibrancy about it that brings things, keeps things alive, you know, like the living nature of the knowledge systems and the stories that are shared. So, for example, you know, the Nabaya dance in there that Scotty's been teaching the young people, that's something that the old people are real proud of, not just because he's passing it on and he's really into it, but he's actually really held that tradition in a way that is properly done. So it's a lot more complicated than maybe some other films that are done in the environmental space where they don't have a whole bunch of other... There's other things that we need to consider. So, for example, the edit, we had, you know, Scotty was a big part of the edit, and we were on the phone constantly. Every frame of the Two Laws archival footage was approved by all the families. Hopefully, films like this and other films show why it's important that if you want justice in the just transition, you need to prioritise Indigenous peoples and other communities at the front line of these huge extractive industries, because those communities are just as important as communities in the city. And, you know, I live in the city and, you know, I ride bikes and, you know, we tried to live a life that has as least impact as possible, but in reality, you know, my phone and the bike battery has got lithium in from Chile, from the Mapuche people, you know. And so, like, being conscious of the decisions we make and the just transition is going to be critical also for the way that we frame this new space, you know, the way we frame the growth of our society. It's like, actually, we need to maybe also look at the ways that we engage with energy and the ways that we live our lives, and not just replace one fossil fuel system with another one that's extractive and also just sort of is damaging.
Absolutely. And John, you sort of mentioned you became involved in this film and telling this story through your connection with Jason. The film reminds us at the end that there are over 160,000 contaminated sites around the country. And we know in recent times about, you know, fish kills in the Murray-Darling and broader environmental issues there around water security and what's sort of going on with that particular river system. And, you know, mining, of course, on First Nations community, Indigenous lands has been a big issue for many, many years as well. And what happened with the Juukan Gorge really highlighted that too, the immense power of mining companies and the destruction that can be wrought on country. And I mean, it seems like there's any number of film projects that could document just these particular instances of injustices that are being experienced by First Nations communities in particular in Australia. I mean, you always have many projects on the go, but how do you decide which projects to focus on and which stories to kind of spotlight, given the importance of so many of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, yeah, because, you know, quite easily be a series on this going across the country and seeing the impacts of things, you know. And, you know, I think, you know, we work in a space that is a really kind of an energetic space, I feel, you know, and you know, we are We are these kind of storytellers who hold energy. Like much of our craft of our storytelling is holding energy. So for me, it's about just trying to sit and be and listen and connect with the energies that are coming in, you know, and that's kind of, that's often will follow that. And you know, there'll be a story around that, you know, rather than, this is a story, going to tell that story, but there's no energy there, you know, there's no connection there. Like for me, it just, it's this other space, and I just be open to, you know, the energy and, you know, those conversations and see where that takes me. And, you know, for me, the process of storytelling, you know, it's a really important thing. Like Brown Cabs is called because of the value of the process, you know, because it's kind of, you know, it's this, based on this kind of running joke I had with my nephew and talking about how taxis weren't picking up brown people, would just drive past brown people and not pick up brown people. And I was like, Uncle, what if there was a taxi service just for brown people, you know? And it's like, yeah, we could call it Brown Cabs. And, and you can jump in and you might just need to go around the block, like one block. But first, because you've got auntie in the front seat and she lives right across on the other side of town, you've got to go all the way over there and then pick up somebody else. So it might take you the full day to get there. But the thing is, it is that journey, you know, it's the journey of it.
Yeah, I never knew that was the origins of the name Brown Cabs. And I suppose there's a tie in there with Kutcher's Carpool Karaoke or Kurioki as well, which has been such a fun thing coming out of Brown Cabs as well. But Jason, I mean, you mentioned before that there's, you know, the enduring legacy of Warbidar Bunanoo, and how does this knowledge sharing that's happening not just within Australia but internationally as well, and of course the issue itself of the kind of environmental impact of the mine, the McArthur River mine, is still happening as well. There's, you know, plans to expand it and so on. Where do you see kind of this story going, and how do you view, I suppose, the public reception to the very real issues, you know, in your community, but also in terms of awareness around climate and ecosystem sustainability generally?
I mean, I feel like the film, for me anyway, at a personal level, has been a real good kind of spark of conversations, some deeper conversations, and you know, it's really helped us to build allied networks and build the movement in a way that is meaningful. So it's an expression of a meeting of values and a willingness to demand more, you know, and to strive for better conditions for future generations, and to be courageous against these huge multinational corporations that are, it's kind of overwhelming at times, I imagine, for a lot of people. I think it's been a bit frustrating just to see all this, you know, the climate justice stuff is fantastic. And, you know, we were on stage with Gadrian and Scotty and Mum Nancy and Stuart at the climate rally down here, the big one, 80,000 people rallying against, for climate justice, you know, mostly young people, the school strikers. And it was a real moment to realise that actually, to see that they understood that these conditions are imposed upon Indigenous peoples. You know, the whole climate stuff is a series of conditions that have come about through colonialism. And you know, tying those together is important, because if we're moving into a time of truth-telling, then let's be truthful about how this has come about. And then also, secondly, I think hopefully these kind of films, and you can just see it happening all over the country, is a greater respect for Indigenous knowledge and practices on country that have been developed over thousands of years that work. And I think that leadership will grow and be respected more, and not only in Australia but internationally. So hopefully that contributes to that kind of growth as well, respect and you know, more leadership in the space from people in the community itself, on the country, decision making on country, rather than sort of like some sort of way of thinking that Canberra can make a decision around, you know, country itself. You know, so I think some of that two laws philosophy and understanding that as well is important moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of that much needed advocacy and activism, Jason, I think it's worth talking a bit about the current situation with fracking in the Beetaloo Basin too. We know there have long been community-led campaigns highlighting the devastating and destructive impact the practice has on country, and particularly, I suppose, on water. What can you tell us about the fights being waged on that front?
You know, one of the things, and, you know, the families are going to continue to fight in communities, but it's an uphill battle when you have, you know, investments, you know, significant $30 million investments into, you know, mining companies to allow them to explore and conduct this kind of activity on country without free, prior, informed consent. And it's a major concern. Fracking is incredibly damaging to water systems. It's destroyed lands and communities in other parts of the world. It's been banned in other parts of the world. And yet, you know, this government has chosen to, and successive governments have chosen to support and fund, as part of the COVID economic economic plan strategy, fund such a destructive force. So yeah, it's a really important fight that will continue to happen, and hopefully we can see more people supporting local communities in their struggle against that.
Absolutely, and an immense additional fight to be waging for, you know, the people in this film who we meet, who have been for a long time talking about the impacts of mining on their country. What does that mean in a strategic sense? I mean, how do people have the energy and the kind of strategic will, I suppose, to continue to raise awareness and try to get change on some of these really destructive practices?
I'm just constantly amazed by the elders' resilience, and just, you know, they're so strong. It's a real inspiration. But also, yeah, you know, I think we should, you know, be, you know, have to do a massive shout out to, you know, Indigenous groups, you know, the young people in SEED and all the work that they're doing, continuing to do the work that we're doing with, you know, our Environmental Defenders Office, you know, and other groups that are really supporting local communities to challenge on a number of different grounds. And hopefully we can see with some of the changes in the national landscape that we see a massive priority in, you know, looking after country and listening to local communities' wishes for what they want to do on their lands. Exploring economic development models that are much more in tune with healthy communities.
Yeah. I grew up fishing and swimming in this river.
Oh, yeah.
Like dry season now, this time of the year, we used to be all over here as a kid. I remember fishing on both sides of the river. Bony Brim and Barramundi floating on the bank, you look. And some of them still there, floating upside down, you're trying to get oxygen. Mm-hmm. We had them independent monitoring mob down here in 2014 and told us that them fish were poison and told us that we only allowed to eat a little bit of them. We used to eat, you know, many fish we can eat, not just a little bit. More, no one don't fish around here anymore. It happened back in 2014, and now we got another problem. It's still coming to us. Soon, later on, we'll probably have a bigger problem than the water contamination. Probably the whole township of Borroloola, the whole water will be contaminated.
You know, you hear those stories, and it's that thing of hearing those stories and across time, and those same stories and the same kind of structure, that it's, you know, very much the tail wagging the dog, you know, and those kind of structures, you know, because of that kind of capitalist kind of money thing just revving to extremes, you know, and we as a community are not having that conversation. And, you know, and I think, you know, the First Nations, everybody gets the benefits of that conversation, you know, by centering, you know, Indigenous people as the first conversation, then the whole of the country will benefit from that, you know, in a way that's about our lives and our existence here. That's not, you know, this fixation of the hip pocket and how much money is in there. You know, when we think about why we're here and what is our connection to each other, you know, that's kind of the, you know, hopeful that those kind of conversations expand within this kind of consciousness and awareness. So we it's more than, like Jason's saying, it's more than just understanding that, oh, we've got to do this thing. Actually, what we have to do is build greater awareness and consciousness around the discussion, because that business model, that's still the same business model as it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago. You know, that hasn't changed. So our awareness is the thing that needs to change around that.
The government doesn't care. The power and water doesn't care. The health department, they doesn't care. The mines doesn't care what happened into our drinking water. It's our right to stand up and fight, and it's our right to have clean water in our community.
You know, one of the inspiring things for me too from the film was just how the community keeps the home fires burning. And across this kind of time and resilience, and, you know, because these are very big, you know, it's David and Goliath kind of battles. You know, you've got very big multinational companies with a lot of money, and governments, and, you know, often companies that have more money than the governments. And I could imagine it would be easy to just completely immerse yourself and lose yourself in that. And, you know, what was amazing for me was just, you know, seeing the community keeping those home fires burning and keeping those stories, keeping those practices alive. And, you know, there was a real focus on that, you know, to see the young people and the kids around that experiencing that. Just so much hope in that and the resilience of it. And you can feel that energy in the kids, you know, and you know, you just know that there's a really strong and positive future.
We got stronger than all these Scotty mob now. It make me feel a lot better and happy. They're strong, they switch on, and they can understand, you know?
What's your name?
Leo.
Where are you from?
Borola.
You're from Borola?
Yeah.
Absolutely, and that comes through so strongly in the film too, singing for country, which we see in the dances and the retainment and the passing on of that knowledge over generations. It still is so richly preserved in the communities that we meet in Walbadar Bunanu.
One thing is, like Scotty says, you know, the songs breathe life back into country, and, you know, I think that was just, you know, it's a real a beautiful vision moving forward.
It's been such a pleasure, such a privilege to speak to you both revisiting Walbadar Bunanu today. Congratulations on the film once again, and it's wonderful to hear that it endures and it's still having these ripple effects in Australia and across the world as well. Jason DeSantolo, John Harvey, thanks so much for being on Seeing Green. It's been great.
Thanks, Dylan.
Thanks, Dylan. Awesome.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Professor Belinda Smale. Mixing and production by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling and hosted by me, Dylan Bird. Follow, rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. This is the last episode for Season 2, and we're taking a break while we work on Season 3. But if you want more Seeing Green, we do have a back catalogue to explore. One of my favourites from this season was our discussion of the depiction of seascape in the psychological thriller Dead Calm, where we explored the idea of the ocean as both threat and refuge.
I was fascinated and, to be frank, perturbed by the place less.
character of Seascape in most of this film.
I couldn't help but thinking, oh, it's Mad Max at sea.
We also went on the trail of the thylacine and unpacked tales of extinction through the lens of 2011 film The Hunter.
All the scenes are quite ugly and confronting, and that stands in contrast to the landscapes of the natural environment, those long shots of something more beautiful.
And we also took a bit of an alternative look at the 1975 shearing drama Sunday Too Far Away, examining gender, animal rights, and the pastoral industry.
Foley has this mop of thick, blonde, curly hair. His hair is very sheep-like.
But a special highlight for me also was our foray into documentary. We followed alongside Tom Cruise as he made his way along the remote Birdsville track in the beguiling 1950s film The Back of Beyond.
So in the archive, we can see these really interesting early examples of environmental film made by oil companies before filmmakers were really getting on board with this.
We also revisited Tom Zabriskie's 2011 doco The Hungry Tide and learned a whole lot more about the existential threat of sea level rise in Kiribati and the resilience of its people from climate change advocate Linda Wan.
10 years or 20 years thereafter, they are starting to realise and acknowledge that there is such a thing as climate change.
And of course, there are many treats from season one, such as our intriguing take on the killer croc film Rogue, DIY and repair culture in Mad Max, colonial alienation in Wake in Fright, and childhood innocence and environmental memory in Storm Boy. If you haven't yet heard those episodes, happy listening, and we'll catch you again really soon for season 3.